You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, live from Washington, D.C. today, and at the Talk Radio News booth in Charlotte, North Carolina. We're going to be having a whole raft of guests coming in. Governor Shemlin is scheduled for this moment. Is he around? He's not around. This is what happens, in, you know, in live television, live radio, when you are dealing with a lot of people who are trying to move around from place to place, and it doesn't always quite work out. But in any case, remember when John Ensign, the senator from Nevada, had an affair with his employee, his number one employee, Doug, what was Doug's name? Doug Hampton. Doug Hampton's wife. And Ensign's parents paid, you know, like hush money, and there was all this huge cover-up and all this stuff. Well, a guy whose wife had an affair with the senator just got sentenced to a year of probation, pled guilty to a misdemeanor. Isn't that bizarre? Josh Marshall has it over at TPM in his So You Thought Life Was Fair? It Ain't category. Like, yeah, the senator, what's happened to the senator? Well, nothing. I mean, he's pretty much not the senator anymore, but other than that, it's really, and we really do have two sets of rules here, one for the rich and powerful in the United States and the other for everybody else. It is quite extraordinary. So last night, did you see the golden hour was 10 to 11. That's the hour that they, Eastern time, that they play on national television. And in that hour, I believe it was Deval Patrick was just before that hour. He gave an incredible speech. He's the current governor of Massachusetts, just totally knocked it out of the park. He was followed by the governor of Maryland. Is that Bob McDonald? Bob O'Malley. O'Malley, that's right. Thank you. Martin O'Malley. Thank you. I gotta learn my local geography, my local governors here, who gave actually what was a very good speech, but it was so, you know, the speeches on either side of it, the previous one by the Massachusetts governor was incandescent. And even though it didn't go on the whole national feed, it was on the cable systems. And, the one that followed it, of course, there was this extraordinary story of this woman who, her daughter, just from being born and with a birth defect, one out of 100 children is born with a heart defect, and she was one of them. She had to have 3 open heart surgeries before she was 5 years old or 4 years old, and it would have wiped out their insurance. And they'd been paying for this insurance policy for, like, you know, decades. And the insurance company is about to say, sorry, we're not going to insure your kid anymore. And then Obamacare kicked in and said, no lifetime limits. And her child is going to get her third operation. And then it went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, yeah, we're going to uphold Obamacare. And it literally saved this woman's family and her child's life. And it was just an incredibly powerful story. Kathleen Sebelius gave a great speech. Michelle Obama, of course, was the highlight of the evening. She was advertised as the highlight of the evening. She was the keynote. She wasn't the keynote speaker. The keynote speaker was actually the mayor of San Antonio, Mr. Castro. Julian Castro, as I recall. And he gave an incredible speech. He had the position that Barack Obama had back when Bill Clinton was running. And Barack Obama gave that speech. Or no, it must have been during one of the George Bush, must have been the Kerry campaign, right, 2004. Obama gave that speech and, you know, knocked it out of the park, and everybody said, okay, he's the guy. And Julian Castro, a twin, interestingly, his twin brother, he's the mayor of San Antonio, his twin brother's running for the House of Representatives from Texas. Identical twins. And he just gave a great speech. And his little kid, he was talking about his daughter, and the camera was on her, and she could see herself clearly on one of the monitors in the stadium, and she started fluffing her hair, you know, and doing the little kid oh, look at that, I'm on TV thing. And then Michelle Obama talked about her husband. She talked, you know, the whole frame for her speech, the box that it was in, was her concern about whether moving into the White House was going to harm her girls, her two daughters, whether it was going to make them live in a bubble and change their lives and turn them into, implicitly, turn them into rich fools, rich jerks. You know, I mean, the most powerful office in the world, and daddy now makes over, you know, makes $1 million from his books and makes, what, $400,000, $600,000 a year as president, whatever the pay is, it's pretty good. Get shuttled around in helicopters and limousines and everything. Is this going to change our daughters? That was the frame she used. And through that frame of her, that she started and ended with, of her daughters saying, no, they're growing up to be good, decent young women. Through that frame, she was able to talk about her husband and their life together and meeting him, and also about policy decisions and the importance of the Obama administration and the importance of policy decisions and the stories that, you know, every night President Obama reads 10 letters from citizens and all that kind of thing, which is a little, you know, in some ways sounds a little bit of, you know, noblesse oblige royalty, but you know, what can you say? I mean, you know, the White House gets thousands of letters every day and addressed to the president. At least he's reading some of them. You know, they're filtering them out, and he is getting some of them. So I thought it was fascinating. One of the comments that was made was that there was a lot. This was made on several blogs this morning, and all I could tell was from the crowd shots, so I don't really know. And it's a question that is probably an indelicate one, but it's an interesting one. Romney has to win 61% of the white vote in order to win, given where he stands with minorities right now. Which means Obama needs to carry 40% of the white vote if he's going to win. And the point that was made was that there might not have been that percentage of white voters, white delegates, whatever, in the convention. I don't know, frankly. But that there was, you know, minorities were overrepresented in this convention relative to previous ones and relative to our population as a whole. And, you know, it's a great thing. So the large tent bringing in you know, a wide variety of people from a wide variety of walks of life. But he also has to bring in that white vote. And I think that that's going to be the job of Joe Biden. Joe Biden, as Sarah Palin called him. That Joe Biden is going to have to reach out to, you know, white working class people like basically he himself was. And, you know, where his roots are. They're in Scranton, Pennsylvania, as I recall, and in Pennsylvania in any case. And just say, you know, we're looking out for your interests, too. It's not even an issue of black or white or Latino or Asian or Hispanic or you know, gay or straight or male or female. It's an issue of America, of America's values, of what we believe as a country, of who we really are. And, you know, those values that the founders founded this country on came out of the Enlightenment. They came out of people like Jean-Jacques Rousseau and you know, just the Thomas Hobbes and John Stuart Mill. Well, it was actually John Stuart Mill was later. He was in the 1860s. But this whole variety of genuine, brilliant 17th century thinkers who all called themselves liberals.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, you know, one of the Democrats' big challenges, and I don't see it as a challenge so much, you know, one of their jobs is to say, you know, we are still the Enlightenment. We are still America.
He believes that when you've worked hard and done well and walked through that doorway of opportunity, you do not slam it shut behind you. No, you reach back and you give other folks the same chances that help you succeed.
Well, you know, Mitt Romney's done that. He set aside $100 million for his five sons, so you know he's reaching out to others, isn't he? I mean, really? Come on. What a cheap shot. Graham Zielinski on the line. He's the communications director of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, wisdems.org. Graham, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me. Mike Tate was going to be here, but he sends his regrets, so thank you so much for remembering Wisconsin.
Well, thank you, and send our regards to him.
Sure.
Graham, I'm curious. You guys know Paul Ryan better than anybody else. Kathleen Sebelius is taking some flack in the media today for saying that Ryan Obamacare would raise the cost to seniors by $6,000 when that was the first Ryan budget. The second Ryan budget was moderated somewhat, and Romney has endorsed the second one. But whether it's the first one, the second one, or the 35th one, Paul Ryan does seem to have some sort of a, I'm reluctant to call it a moral compass, but some sort of a governing philosophy. You want to describe what it is?
Well, I know the nuns of the Archdiocese and what they would say about it. They would say that it's totally inconsistent with Catholic social teaching. But when he came out with this plan originally, his original plan, our party, the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, as a sort of a spoof, we had Paul Ryan Medicare voucher coupons, you know, good for a half hour of dialysis, good for one catheter. And we gave them out in the district, and we talked around to seniors, and they recognized immediately what his plan was. It's not just that it's going to cost seniors more out of pocket. It's that it ends the guarantee of health care. So seniors who can't find their health care on the open market are going to be one illness away from the poorhouse.
How can we get the Democratic Party to do that nationally? That's a brilliant idea.
If you want to Google Paul Ryan Medicare voucher coupons, and my buddy, I used to work at the Onion newspaper, and my buddy's the former editor of the Onion. He did up a pretty funny graphic with the coupons, but they strike the larger point that this is what they are. They're coupons that you're trusting the open market and ending the guarantee. And we've known this for a long time. Paul Ryan, remember, has never faced an election in Wisconsin since he introduced this crazy budget. Everybody says, "Oh, Paul Ryan's been running the table in Wisconsin," and that's true. He's outspent his opponents 30-1 until Rob Zurban. He's never had a serious challenger, and he's been having the same fibbing problems all along. But nobody's vetted his record because nobody's looked, and he's had this charade where he's hidden behind, "Oh, I'm a deer hunter. Oh, I'm a Packers fan," and now that people see this dang budget, people are scared in this district, and I know because my parents are seniors. They live in the district. They're damn scared. Yeah. And if you look now and see what kind of money Paul Ryan is spending on his congressional race, where he's never spent this kind of money before, it's because the people of Wisconsin know his plan. They don't like his plan, and they're rejecting him.
Yeah. Now, speaking of rejecting, I'm curious. There's a piece on Common Dreams right now, and it's repurposed from someplace else. I'm not sure where. About how a canvasser for Obama in Madison gave up because she was in Democratic districts knocking on so many doors where progressives were saying Obama didn't come to town to fight for the recall. He has, you know, dropped the ball on this, that, or the other thing. Pick, you know, take your choice, free trade, NDAA, whatever. And, you know, we're just not as enthusiastic as we were last time around. How are you going to close that enthusiasm gap? How do you bring those people back? How do you get those yard signs out there? How do you wake people up and get them going again when some progressives, and I'm not one of them. I think President Obama's done a reasonably good job given the circumstances. But I, you know, you and I both know there are a lot of people who are sitting around saying, well, you know, it wasn't perfect, damn it, so I'm not going to be there like I was 4 years ago.
Yeah, well, I mean, the perfect candidate can only be find me the perfect candidate, but I don't see that. Maybe it's because I'm an activist. I'm on the ground all the time, and I'm with these people. The people in Madison who are part of the recall are my friends. The people in Milwaukee and Superior, whatever. I've been all around the state with the recall, and now, as we've woken up, and it's not just reelecting this president, but it's keeping the Senate majority with a strong progressive like Tammy Baldwin in office. People in Wisconsin, let me tell you, have been having this conversation about the economic security of the middle class and fighting these special interests like the Koch brothers. We had the battle come to us a little early. Yeah. And I haven't seen this piece
so
that you're talking about.
Your experience is that those people who worked on the recall are still equally as enthusiastic.
And you look at our delegation here to this convention. I think something like 70-75% of them are newcomers, and all those newcomers, I think to a woman and a man, all of those newcomers were woken up by the recall, and now they're here supporting the president because those same values about the economic security of the middle class and what's going to happen to us. Who's going to rule? These Koch brothers, are they going to come in and be able to buy our state? Or are you going to be able to fight back and right. organize?
They did successfully buy your state, you know, in the recall.
Yeah.
Do you think that they're going to do it again in the general election?
And there's many reasons when it comes to timing, when it comes to turnout. Turnout was actually a lot lower than was predicted. Let's not forget. I think Scott Walker didn't win on the question of is Scott Walker a good governor or not. He won on the question of do people like recalls. And
well, that's because they ran all these ads saying, you know, we don't like recalls.
For 7 months, they had the air to themselves. I think it's a lot fairer fight when it comes to the resources that President Obama has now. It's a lot fairer fight when it comes to the resources that Tammy Baldwin has now. And the argument is so much clearer. And then other stuff that we haven't talked about. Students are going to be able to vote now that weren't because of the Republican game-changing on the rules. Students weren't really a factor in the recall election. Well, they are now, with Pell Grants being cut and health care being cut and all this stuff. And you're going to have a much bigger turnout.
And didn't Scott Walker cut the students out of the vote with a voter suppression ID law?
That's exactly what he did, and is exactly the point of that suppression. You nailed it on the head.
Yeah. I never refer to them as voter ID laws.
They're suppression. Jim Crow.
Everybody should call them voter suppression.
Modern
ID
day
laws.
Jim Crow, absolutely.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Graham Zielinski, the communications director of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, wisdems.org is the website. Thanks, Graham.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll be back with more of my thoughts, your calls, and our guests from the live from Charlotte, North Carolina, from the DNC.
Now all the criminals in the coats and the ties are free to drink martinis and watch the sunrise. While Reuben sits like Buddha in a 10-foot cell, an innocent man in a living hell. Is that the story of the hurricane?
An innocent man in a 10-foot cell. Well, that's appropriate. Governor Don Siegelman is on the line with us, former governor of Alabama. The website, donsiegelman.org. And, Governor, welcome back to our program.
Oh, thanks, Tom. I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you for joining us. What's the latest on this case of yours where Karl Rove and his buddies went after you with this frivolous prosecution and actually got a judge to throw you in jail?
Well, the most interesting thing that happened at the convention, Karl Rove just came up to my daughter and wagged his finger in her face and said, "Tell your dad not to use my name for fundraising anymore."
Seriously?
Just a few minutes ago. We missed it on camera, but anyway, it sounded like he was saying, "Okay, now we've sent your dad to jail, so that ought to be a warning to him." But, you know, this whole prosecution, as you well know, started out as a political dirty trick by Karl Rove to do damage to me before my 2002 re-election campaign.
Right.
And then because the prosecutor's husband was working for my political opponent, it, you know, grew legs of its own because they had a vested interest in seeing that I was not only prosecuted, but that I was convicted. We have, of course, you know, all of the evidence points to Karl Rove and a Jack Abramoff conspiracy, and we may or may not want to get into that. But the latest, of course, is I'm about to go back to prison. I'm going back to prison in 6 days for something that has never been considered a crime in America. In fact, I have the distinction of being the first person ever sent to prison for raising money for an issue advocacy campaign, in this case to send kids to college for free, where there was no self-enrichment scheme.
There was nothing in it for you.
No, nothing in it for me. The government never argued that. So I have now been convicted and sentenced by a judge with whom I've had a political battle for the last 10 years, and going to prison for 6.5 years, unless President Obama will issue a pardon or a commutation. So I'm here today and the last couple of days and tomorrow to see some of my friends and remind them that while Karl Rove sent me to prison, it's their job to get me out.
Well, and I should read the liner that I read every day twice as we go into our newscast with Talk Radio News Service and as we come out of the newscast, which reads, "This Talk Radio News Service report is brought to you by the efforts to free America's newest political prisoner, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. Sign the petition asking President Obama to pardon Don Siegelman at change.org.
Well, yeah, there are two ways to get to it. One is donsiegelman.org.
Okay.
And that takes it directly to my website. And then change.org /pardondon will get the petitioners to the right spot to sign.
Okay. I will update what we're reading to our viewers and listeners every day then to donsiegelman.org and change.org/ what was that again? Pardon Don?
Yeah, change.org/pardondon.
Okay, you got it.
But this case, as we have said for, you and I have discussed for over 4 years now, is bigger than just me. It's not about, yes, it is about my freedom now. Of course, I don't want to go to prison, and I want to get out as soon as possible. But, you know, two things need to be underscored in this petition to the president. One is that the Justice Department was used as a political weapon. We've got to get to the truth. And secondly, you know, this kind of abuse of justice should not be allowed to continue. So Congress and the courts have to take some action to straighten out the laws. But we've also got to have a justice system that really seeks justice and not just prosecutions for the sake of convictions.
Yeah, there's a new book out called Boss Rove. I interviewed the author of it a couple of days ago. It's coming out this week, actually. And there's a whole chapter in it about you and your case. And it's actually one of the better articulations of what happened that I've read. So FYI for our viewers and our listeners. But it's all over at donsiegelman.org. You can check it out. And Governor Siegelman, how goes it in your efforts?
Well, of course, I'm here among friends at the Democratic National Convention, and you know it's been amazing. I have run into some of my former colleagues who have been and are governors, and members of Congress and others who have been part of the Democratic Party for a long time, and I don't have to say a thing. They shake their head with understanding and disgust with the injustice and pledge their help and support. So just my presence here has been enough without my trying to, to interrupt the flow of the convention. You know, after all, these delegates are here for one reason, and that's to reelect President Obama. And I would be the last person to try to interfere with that or
sure.
confuse the message. So,
yeah.
But I've been blessed by the support here.
Yeah, well, and it's a fine thing. You are, in my opinion, America's newest political prisoner. You want to summarize real quickly? We've got about 4 minutes here. How you came to be a political prisoner?
Well, I think that I got on Karl Rove's radar screen years ago. I've been doing battle with him since 1994. But when I was elected governor, I defeated an incumbent Republican. There was a confluence of issues then, because Abramoff was also working against me in 1998 and was working against the education lottery that I was proposing to send free kids to college for free. And he also pumped money in with Ralph Reed and Grover Norquist to defeat me in 2002. It was Karl Rove's pardoner and Jack Abramoff's employee who claimed credit for stealing my election in 2002. The reason why that election was important to them, I think, simply was that I was being touted as a possible dark horse candidate for the Democratic nomination in 2004, and I had to win my reelection campaign. Even though they went to great lengths to tarnish my reputation before 2003, I won the election anyway. So that forced them into Plan B, which was to steal the election, which they did after the lights went out in the South Alabama courthouse, Republican courthouse. They recapitulated the votes at, and took 5,000 of my votes, gave it to my opponent, declared him the winner. The person who stopped my recount, which would have proven that I would have won, that I did win the election, was Karl Rove's partner, the Attorney General, I'm sorry, Karl Rove's client, the Attorney General of Alabama, who also participated in the illegal certification of the votes the next day. It was Karl Rove's client who was then rewarded with a seat on the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals.
Wow.
So the story goes on, but at the heart of it, it was politics. As Grant Woods, who is a former Republican Attorney General from Arizona, said, Don Sigelman was a Democrat they couldn't beat, so they targeted him with this prosecution.
Yeah. The fellow who wrote this book, Boss Rove, I'm forgetting his name right at the moment, but he said that they started looking at all the prosecutions done by the federal prosecutors during the Bush years when Karl Rove was running the White House. And it was something like 3-1 that they were prosecuting Democrats over Republicans. And he considered those to be mostly political prosecutions. Yours, of course, was the most obvious, the most egregious.
Well, I think, I certainly have not been the only person. And unless there is some effort to underscore the injustice in this case, and unless there's some effort to depoliticize the Department of Justice, then these kinds of prosecutions are more likely to happen in the future under this ruling. I was not convicted on the basis of an express agreement. I was not convicted of bribery under an explicit agreement. I was not convicted of bribery under an asserted agreement. I was convicted of bribery under an implied agreement. So the judge allowed the jury to imply from the evidence that there was an agreement instead of proving that there really was an agreement. So, that's where we find ourselves now, and that's why attorney generals, law professors, and even George Will has spoken out in favor of the Supreme Court reviewing this case and straightening out and clarifying this law.
Yeah, and this is such an injustice. So if you would like to sign the petition to ask President Obama to pardon Don Sigelman, and this is an important issue, go to donsiegelman.org, I before E, Don, SIEGELMAN.org, and that there's a link from there to change.org/pardondon, where you can encourage the president. It hits a certain threshold and it actually goes to the White House. Encourage the president to consider a pardon for Governor Sigelman. Governor, thank you so much for being with us today.
Tom, thank you very much.
And keep up the good work. Say hi to Dana for me.
I'll do it.
And I wish you the very best, sir. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
That's amazing. And just a half hour ago, Karl Rove came up and threatened his daughter. I mean, it's like the center of evil. Tom Harbin here with you, and Governor Dan Malloy, the governor of Connecticut, governor.ct.gov. The website is on the air with us live from Radio Row. Talk Radio News is Radio Row there at the DNC. Governor Malloy, welcome to our program.
Hey, it's great to be with you. It's a real opportunity to talk to people about what's going on in the country.
Indeed. Thank you for joining us. First, your sense of what's going on there at the convention.
Hey, this is my fifth convention, and I probably watched another dozen conventions over the years. That was the best opening night of any convention I have ever seen. Quite frankly, I think it topped most of the closing nights of any convention that I've ever seen. Mrs. Obama was just on fire. Ted Strickland, you know, he reminded me of a college biology professor on a frog. He just took Mitt Romney apart.
Yep.
My good friend Martin O'Malley did a great job. Deval Patrick, brilliant, brilliant speech. You know, the people, you can feel the excitement in the hall last night, but you can feel it here today as we're gathering for another session. And, of course, we're going to hear from Bill Clinton tonight. I get to give a little speech, but Bill Clinton, I think, is going to really crystallize the difference between Democratic leadership in this country, leadership that's willing to actually go the extra way to make sure that our middle class is growing, as a way of paying down our debt. You have to grow this economy if you want to pay off the debt. You don't give more money to rich people to grow the middle class. You give money to the middle class. You spend it on job creation, on education, on health care. That's how you grow a middle class.
Yeah, well said. What time is your speech so I can be sure not to miss it?
I'm on around, I'm in the 6 o'clock hour. I think I'm going to be on around 6:40 or 6:30, somewhere in that. So it's early. But
oh,
listen, any time you get to speak to your fellow Democrats is a good day.
No, that's marvelous. We get off the air at 6 o'clock. We're talking with Governor Dan Malloy, the governor of Connecticut. Governor.ct.gov is the website. Governor, what do you see as the, and perhaps you've already summarized this, and if so, my apologies, but what do you see as the biggest issues facing America that, where there is a clear separation line between the Obama-Biden policies, the Democratic policies, and the Romney-Ryan Republican policy?
Well, listen, Ryan, in that budget, which Mitt Romney said he would sign, actually changes Medicare into a voucher program, a voucher that would cover half the cost. So senior citizens living in the United States would have to write out a check for health care of about $6,200 to $6,400. That would put many senior citizens, millions upon millions of senior citizens in our country, into poverty. That's the Ryan budget.
Now, the Romney folks are saying that was the first Ryan budget, which was passed by virtually every Republican in the House of Representatives. But the second Ryan budget, which is the one that Romney endorses, that one provides you with the choice of staying on Medicare or buying into one of these, you know, getting a voucher and buying into one of these corporate plans, which in my mind, you know, may not cost you an extra $6,000 a year, but what's going to happen is it's going to ghettoize Medicare. That's just like with school choice. If the health insurance companies won't take the vouchers from really sick people, they're going to end up in Medicare, and Medicare is going to end up really being broke.
Yeah, you know, Medicare as a program is not broken. It is a contract we have with our fellow citizens that if you're lucky enough to get older in the United States, you're not going to have to worry about health care. That program works. It keeps millions upon millions of Americans out of poverty. Perhaps it is as important as Social Security. For many people, it's more important than Social Security, and they want to tamper with it. Why do they want to tamper with it? They want their friends to make a profit on it. There should be no profit in Medicare. This is a sacred guarantee that we have made with men and women in this country who have been working for that program to make sure that they would be taken care of. Don't tamper with it. That part of it's not broken. Fund it properly and get it and allow it to do what it's already doing, and that is to raise our senior citizens out of poverty. If you look statistically at the United States, the group that has moved from poverty more rapidly than any other group in our country over the last 70 years are the elderly. A Democratic proposal, no Republican support Social Security. A Democratic proposal, no Republican support Medicare. That's what's done it, and now they want to take them apart. They can't stand the success that those programs have had.
Right, and like FDR famously said, they're saying, oh, we love these programs. We just don't like the way the Democrats administer them. Give them to us, and we'll take care of them. We'll do it better. We'll do it cheaper. And it won't cost anybody anything.
And quite frankly, the theory doesn't work. it's as bad as many of their other theories of trickle-down economics. Or somehow, by making some group of people wealthy, you're going to make everyone wealthy. Listen, we get stronger in the United States when we have a growing working class. We have a growing working class more often than not when Democrats are in the office, in office as the president. We're going to hear from Bill Clinton. Nobody grew the middle class more rapidly than Bill Clinton, and nobody was in a position to pay down the deficit and eliminate the deficit like Bill Clinton was. He was replaced by Bush. Bush starts two wars without a plan to pay for it, and now Republicans have the chutzpah to complain that we have a deficit. They approved that law, those wars, without a plan to pay for it.
Right, plus a tax cut without a plan to pay for it, and Medicare Part D without a plan to pay for it. You know, one of the lies that I am so struck by, I have heard it probably 15 or 20 times in the last 48 hours from the obligatory right-wing pundits that these news shows always have on, and no news anchor ever pushes back on it, is, you know, somebody will say, well, you know, Bill Clinton balanced the budget, and Bill Clinton did, you know, things went great with that. And they say, yes, well, Bill Clinton was willing to reach across the aisle and work with Republicans. But
not a single Republican vote in the program that led to balancing the budget. I remember that. I'm old enough. I'm 57 years old.
Absolutely. I remember it, too. And I remember Newt Gingrich standing on the floor of the House of Representatives and giving a speech saying, if this passes, this 3% tax hike on rich people, if this passes, it will throw us into the next Great Depression. And I don't understand how these guys get away with these lies.
They were wrong about those economics, and they've been wrong about economics time and time and time again. And if you doubt what I say, think about the Bush years. Think about the Great Recession. The only reason that's not a depression is that Barack Obama single-handedly saved the American auto industry.
Amen. Governor Dan Malloy, thanks so much for being with us, and good luck tonight.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Senator Paul Strauss, attorney and shadow senator, seat 2 of the District of Columbia, superdelegate in 2008. PaulStrauss.org, his website, is on the line with us. Mr. Strauss, welcome to the program. Senator Strauss, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. What is a shadow senator?
Well, I'm elected by the residents of Washington, D.C., who can vote for me, but when I go to the Senate, I can't return the favor and cast a vote on their behalf when I go to the Senate floor.
So, like Eleanor Holmes Norton in the House of Representatives?
It is, but at least Delegate Norton has certain speaking privileges, but she can't vote. In the Senate, the right to speak is paramount, so a non-voting but speaking senator could filibuster and quickly get what they wanted. It works a little differently, but you're not far off.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah, I live here in D.C., although I've only lived here a short while, and I'm still kind of learning my way around. How is it that all this time, I mean, Washington, D.C. has a population that is larger than Wyoming, it's larger than Vermont, it's larger than probably four or five states. How is it that we, you know, and I know in the beginning, you know, the founders had this idea that, you know, they'd create this district of the goddess. America should have a goddess. They'd call it Columbia. She's been on our coins forever. You know, she was on the early flags and things and everything else. And hail liberty. She's out in the New York Harbor. And that the people who worked in the district of the goddess would be so committed to God's work or to a sacred work, the sacred work of democracy. They didn't call it God's work. That they wouldn't even be allowed to vote. They would be so above all that. And, you know, it was a nice, idealistic notion in 1770 or 1787, but now we've got people who represent, you know, who live in a city that is larger than most states or some states,
yep,
who have no representation in Congress. How go the efforts to change that?
Well, the Democratic Party has some language in the platform supporting equal rights, but we're a little disappointed that they didn't come out for full statehood. That struggle is an ongoing one, and it's a difficult one. You know, our population may be larger than many states, but it tends to be blacker than many states. It tends to be bluer than many states. So if we had a population that looked, for example, more like Wyoming or Vermont, it may not be as controversial an issue. But if you look at the parts of the United States where the majority of the population is non-white, D.C., the Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, Guam, American Samoa, all of those seem to lack equal rights. And I don't think that's much of a coincidence.
Yeah, I suspect you're right. And as that demographic shift is occurring in the United States and as the white majority is diminishing, do you think that, that demographic shift is going to be the thing that's going to drive the possibility of statehood for D.C.? Although D.C. is experiencing its own gentrification sort of demographic shift. I believe D.C. this year is becoming more than 50% white, or did I read that wrong?
Well, young people are moving back to cities because they're great places to live. Nobody wants to artificially live out in the suburbs just so their kids have to go to segregated schools anymore like the old days.
Yeah.
So cities are coming back, you're experiencing a resurgence, and the district is attracting all kinds of people, black, white, Latino. The population is changing.
Yeah, and that's a, you know, presumably a good thing, I suppose. What do you see as the big issues before the Democratic National Convention today?
Well, obviously, we in the district have our issues with Democrats and Republicans on statehood, but the Republicans have come out against it, so we didn't come here to fight with Democrats. We want to work with them to win in November. President Obama has been historically a supporter of statehood. There have been a lot of progressive causes he supported that he hasn't been able to get to, but we're hoping that in the second term we will. Tonight, the focus is going to be on getting our message out, moving forward, not going back to the policies from 4 years and before, and compared to what Mr. Romney's vision is, not going back to the failed policies of the 1950s and 40s that are going to take this country back in a direction we don't want it to go.
Yeah, well, he really wants to revive Reaganomics and Bushonomics, and that didn't work out so well. It killed
off
the middle
class.
Well,
some of his deregulation ideas are more akin to the days of Herbert Hoover, even. So
yeah.
We have to really preserve the work that we've done. Obviously, we haven't accomplished everything that we as Democrats had hoped we would for the country, but there are a lot of accomplishments that we're not doing as good a job about talking about. So hopefully...
For example?
We passed health care for all Americans. We have pay equity. We have ended the war in Iraq and brought those troops home. We're winding down the war in Afghanistan, we hope. We have a lot of accomplishments. We still have a lot of work to do. But moving forward isn't always easy. We have to make sure that we keep this country on the track that it's going and that we don't go back to letting Wall Street run unregulated again, that we don't allow the voter suppression efforts to keep minorities and African Americans and others who are trying to participate in the democratic process from doing that. And hopefully one day we're going to reintegrate the nation's capital actually into the nation and give the American citizens who live there, who fight for their country, who pay federal taxes, the same rights as their neighbors in the other states.
Yeah, it seems like a reasonable thing. It just seems like a, you know, it's so bizarre that I've moved to the city where I have lost my representation, or at least my vote, or the vote of representation in both the House and the Senate. It's totally bizarre. Are there, you know, most states send two senators. Do you have a colleague?
I do. His name is Michael Brown. He is the so-called junior senator. I have been... Reverend Jackson is my more famous predecessor. He was the first D.C. shadow senator. But shadow senators aren't actually a District of Columbia invention. The territory that became Tennessee is recently, as the territory of Alaska, all elected shadow senators as part of their bids for statehood. So we are following in a long and American tradition. And I actually wanted to, if it's all right, just correct you. When the District of Columbia was created from 1790 to 1801, D.C. residents had voting representation in Congress. It was actually the Congress themselves, by an act of legislation, that took away our federal voting rights in 1801.
During the Jefferson administration.
Congress took it away. Congress can bring it back. And that's what statehood is about. It's actually true to the vision of the framers. As a fellow D.C. resident, you know that there is a neighborhood, there are areas that are exclusively federal. We call it the National Capital Service Area.
Right.
But you know instinctively whether you're in federal Washington or the residential District of Columbia. So if you're in the Southwest Waterfront or Tenleytown or Anacostia, you're in the District of Columbia. If you're on the National Mall on Capitol Hill or the White House, you're in that federal enclave. Statehood isn't about taking away federal control of the federal district. It's about bringing self-determination to the non-federal parts of the District of Columbia, where more people live, as you pointed out, than the citizens of many, many states.
Yeah, yeah. I actually live down on the waterfront. Spot on. Does the rest of the Senate recognize your shadow senator status, or do you show up for Senate sessions, things like that? Is there a place for you there?
I do. They give me certain courtesies. They don't give me the rights and privileges that I deserve as somebody who represents an American citizen like yourself. There are Democrats that are friendlier than others. There are Republicans that are friendlier than others. But what we need to do is change the structural relationship so that D.C. gets full statehood. We've experimented with various incremental measures. You know, obviously we get to vote in the Electoral College. We're here at the DNC with an equal delegation compared based on our population. But when it comes to the important rights and privileges, we still don't have that, and that's what we're pushing for.
Yeah, and good luck with that. When was the last time serious legislation was introduced for statehood for D.C.?
Well,
or has it ever been?
We have serious legislation that's been introduced. The problem is that we can't even get this Congress and this Senate to pass legislation, pass a budget that deals with the issues of our nation. It's tough to get anything dealing with just one particular jurisdiction, even when it deals with so many fundamental rights. Yeah. The obstructionist agenda in the House of Representatives has stopped meaningful efforts on a lot of issues, including D.C. statehood.
Yeah, you're right. And not to mention the filibuster obstructions in the Senate over the last three and a half years. Senator Paul Strauss, shadow senator for C2 of the District of Columbia and a superdelegate in 2008, paulstrauss.org, the website. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tom. It's been great to be with you.
Nice to meet you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, that was interesting. Nice to meet my senator. 16 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
I have seen firsthand that being president doesn't change who you are. No, it reveals who you are.
There you go. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Congressman Alan Grayson, former U.S. Congressman from the 8th District of Florida, running to regain his seat. His website, congressmanwithguts.com. Back on our program, on the air with us, live from the DNC. Congressman, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom. It's good to be here. Thank you very much.
It's great to have you here. So what's going on there from your point of view?
Well, I think from Alan West's point of view, this place is jam-packed full of socialists and communists.
Yes, and Alan West, ironically, was just put on charge of Mitt Romney's minority outreach or something to that effect.
Well, at least they got one black vote coming for them. That might be the only black vote.
It is really sad and tragic. So but beyond the funny talking point, to be serious, my sense of last night was that it was not only one of the best opening nights I've ever seen in a convention, one of the best nights I've ever seen in a convention, period, and that this convention has the real possibility of turning a lot of people into enthusiastic Democrats and winning this election.
Yes.
If enough people watch it and pay attention to it. What do you think?
Well, it's such a dramatic contrast to what they saw last week. Three, 4 days of trite nonsense from the Republicans, yammering about liberty and freedom, the liberty not to see a doctor when you're sick and the freedom to sleep under a bridge. And here you have Democrats talking about real solutions to the real problems in people's lives, whether it's seeing a doctor, getting a job, keeping your home, educating your children. Here we're talking about real things. They were talking about nonsense.
Yeah. And the real things include that list that you just went through and others?
Yes. The Democratic Party is the party that actually is grappling with reality. The Republicans are trying to cast the spell. They want people to believe that if we just do nothing about anything, then everything will be fine. And
right.
When you have a problem, their answer is always the same, prayer. They'll pray for you, but they won't help you. The
right.
Democratic Party gives people a helping hand when they need it. The Republicans will pray for you.
Yeah, and that's been the case for the better part of, since the 1870s, when what was once a reform party, the Republican Party under Abraham Lincoln, was captured by the railroad barons.
And Teddy Roosevelt tried to change that.
Right.
Tried to change it, but in the end, he couldn't do it.
No.
He gave up and started a third party because he was so disgusted with the Republican Party that he came to know too well.
Yep. So how is it that most Americans haven't figured this out?
Well, I think that what's holding them back is this tribalism that the Republicans have tried to induce. They've tried to round up all of the angry white people that they could find and put them together in one political party. The Democratic Party's always been the party for everybody. The Republicans are trying to win by inducing this sense of embattlement among angry whites. And I think that's held people back. I often hear people ask the question, why do people vote against their self-interest? They're almost always referring to white voters who vote Republican. And
right.
The reason for that is that the Republican Party is willing to make overt racist appeals to keep their white non-coalition together.
Yeah, and you're right. It is a form of tribalism, and it's tragic. It's really tragic in this country. You know, it's given our history and given our ideals. How goes your race?
I'm cautiously optimistic.
Uh-huh.
No, I mean, what happened was, it's kind of interesting, actually. The Republicans threw in the towel in Orlando. What they had done 10 years ago after the last census is they divided Orlando into 6 pie slices in order to dilute the Democratic downtown vote. And we managed to pick off one of those pie slices in 2008. Another Democrat, Suzanne Cosens, picked off another pie slice in 2008. And the result of that was that they knew that they were on very shaky ground with all the pie slices. So instead what they did after the last census, because the Republicans control the state legislature, the state house, and so on, what they did after the last census is that they threw in the towel and created a Democratic district in Orlando for the first time ever. And I was unopposed running for that district for the Democratic nomination. Now we've got a classic Democrat versus Tea Party race coming up in November with the numbers on our side. The question, of course, is what's the outside spending going to be like? Last time they hit me, the super PACs on the right hit me with more outside spending. Vicious, awful, negative ads, carpet bombing the district with $5.5 million of negative ads against me to try to keep me out of Congress last time. We'll see if they do the same thing again. They literally ran more ads against me in my district, $5.5 million worth, than any member of Congress anywhere in the country ever. I was their little lab rat last time to see what they could get away with Citizens United. We'll see if it happens again.
That's remarkable. And I'm guessing that it probably will happen. Do you have any sense yet whether the Koch brothers and the Chamber of Commerce and the other big donors, the multinational corporations and whatnot, whether they've thrown money into your district, or are you just going to have to wait and find out?
Last time was $2 million from the Koch brothers. It was $2 million from the health insurance companies because of my support for universal health care.
Wow.
It was $1 million from the National Republican Party, who said I was their number one target for 2010. Little old me, a first-term Democrat from a red district,
wow.
I was their number one target. And $500,000 from the Chamber of Commerce. So far, the Chamber of Commerce has spent another $500,000, and another different super PAC has put down $1 million in reserve for October. And that's all we've seen so far. I don't think $1 million is going to beat me, though. I think it's going to take more than that.
Yeah. So do you answer their attacks, or do you, I mean, what's your, well, how do you deal with this kind of thing?
Well, you know, we have to figure that out. Obviously, we didn't answer them well enough last time. I lost, but I lost in a district that had been Republican for 34 years before I beat them in 2008, running a progressive campaign and serving in Congress as a progressive. I don't know exactly what the right formula is, but in the same way that they test and test and test their messages, we have to test and test and test our response. What's working for us, I think, is the truth. That's what benefits us, because they can't fight that.
Yeah. That generally is the thing that wins, and the challenge is making sure that people know which is the truth. You know, it's whose truth is actually true.
Right.
Congressman Alan Grayson, running for to regain his seat in the 8th District of Florida, and congressmanwithguts.com, the website. Thank you, Congressman.
Thank you, too, Tom.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And we'll be right back with more of my thoughts, your calls, and visitors from the DNC. Stick around.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live from Washington, D.C., and live from the Democratic National Convention, the DNC, in Charlotte, North Carolina. The former governor of Kansas, the current Secretary of Health and Human Services, member of the Obama cabinet, Kathleen Sebelius. Secretary Sebelius, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, Tom. I hear you have your own health challenges these days.
Yeah, I have, and I'm getting through it.
Okay, good.
Thank you. I could have used Obamacare, I think. But anyway, you are, first of all, I watched your speech last night. I thought it was spectacular.
Thank you.
And I just wanted to say that. Not gratuitous at all. I genuinely mean it. I thought it was spectacular. And brilliantly written and delivered. And you are the holder of the, if my understanding is correct, of your job description, you're the holder of the responsibility for implementing and making Obamacare work. Do I have that right?
That's correct, yes.
So tell us about the pieces of Obamacare that people know about and the pieces that people don't know about. Because it seems like there's been a lot of really rather poor communication over the last couple of years or perhaps, I don't know, maybe that's not even the problem. Whatever it is, most Americans don't seem to understand the details of Obamacare.
Well, I think there was a lot of fear left over from the debate when the act was being considered by Congress that somehow if you had insurance that you liked, something bad was going to happen. Right. And for a lot of Americans, they're pretty happy with their employer-based coverage. They are pretty satisfied. They don't want the cost to keep going up and up and up, but they like the doctor they see. They like the health plan they're in. What we need to do is have those people understand that nothing changes. If you have insurance you like, you can keep it. And that this really strengthens the insurance rules. So a lot of those folks, Tom, this summer got rebates from their insurance companies, a remarkable activity. 13 million Americans got a check from their insurance company because if the company did not spend 80 cents of every health dollar collected on health benefits, they had to send money back to their consumers. So we've gotten literally thousands of testimonies from people who said, I just got a check, I'm stunned. Yeah. So that's the portion of the folks who have coverage. Then there's a whole group of small business owners or individuals who really have coverage that is pretty lousy. They don't have much of a choice. They're in a market monopoly, and their costs skyrocket, and there's very little in the way of rules to protect them. They get to look forward to a new exchange in 2014 to a competitive market, private plans to choose from, but they're suddenly be part of a much bigger pool. They don't have to do anything or join anything. They will be able to have coverage. And for those who don't have employer-based coverage, they may get some help from government purchasing insurance. And then there's a whole set of folks who are already benefiting from the plan. So we know that parents are well aware that their children who are up to age 26 can stay on family plans because already 3 million young Americans now have insurance who were uninsured 2 years ago when the law was passed. We know that there are about 33 million seniors who are beginning to take advantage of the new health benefits in Medicare that have preventive services with no copays or no deductibles, or they are getting a discount on their drugs. So, Tom, what I'm seeing is as the benefits begin to get into place, people are far more aware of now what is changing that they like and what's at risk if this law is repealed.
Secretary Sebelius, you mentioned in your talk last night that you were from Kansas stock, as was President Obama, that you understood Kansas women. You're one of them. I'm curious your thoughts on the title of Thomas Frank's book, What's the Matter with Kansas? Why is it that so frequently we find middle-class people voting against their best interests? Why were there all these people who were not people, they were not the billionaire, millionaire class at the RNC, so many of the delegates, they were just average people who were standing up and cheering the doing away with Obamacare, for example, and going back to a system where your health insurance company, well, as that young woman who spoke last night about her daughter with the heart operations, where your insurance company could simply tell you that, hey, yeah, you've been paying in for 25 years, but tough luck.
Well, I think we are still dealing with fundamental big change in this country, and this debate has been underway in America for almost 70 years. Republican presidents and Democratic presidents have put forward health plans. Never before in the history of the United States has a comprehensive plan been passed that affects really the entire under 65 population. So it was relatively easy, I think, to frighten people about what could happen to them, about the bad things that would come, and to continue to repeat that somehow this was a government takeover of health care. And if you thought you were going to lose your insurance and that the government was going to take over your health plan, you wouldn't like it either. Unfortunately,
actually,
that
I
was
want
just
a government
a lie.
Takeover. But, you know, I get it that's a lie.
You wouldn't believe, maybe you would, Tom, how many seniors say to me, I really need government to stay out of my Medicare. They really don't understand that Medicare is a government program. That is a single-payer plan that is entirely run and operated, and most people think it is a terrific benefit.
Yeah, maybe on the Medicare logo you need to include the words the federal government in small type under, you know, under where it says Medicare or something. I mean, it's let's educate these folks to what's going on. So what do you see happening at this convention as we go forward? What's your list of things that you would like to see accomplished?
Well, I think first of all, to get the message out about what has been done in the last 4 years and why it was important for this president as he looked at some of the worst economic situations since the Great Depression, why he chose to do what he did, how important the Recovery Act was, which sent tax credits to 95% of Americans, what the Affordable Care Act is about and how that will impact people on into the future and for generations to come. What about college scholarships and Pell Grants and the building projects? So first to explain about the last 4 years and then to talk about the future, where we want to go in this country and the kinds of effort that it's going to take to get there. That's what Forward is all about. It's we have made progress. We have not made enough progress, because until we have a full economic recovery, until we have folks back at work at jobs that pay a living wage and health security for all families in this country, we won't be where we need to be. But boy, we've made a lot of progress from where we were. You know, the former Notre Dame football coach had a great saying. He would start every season and saying, we're not where we want to be, we're not where we ought to be, but thank God we're not where we used to be. And I think that's exactly where we are in this election.
Secretary Sebelius, you're a member of the Obama cabinet. You sit in on the cabinet meetings. I'm curious, what's it like? How formal or informal is it? How is it working with President Obama?
Well, I'm a very biased observer. I'm a huge fan of this president. I endorsed him early. I think he is doing a spectacular job. We have a very collegial, very competent cabinet who work together on all kinds of issues. One of the things that the president says to us over and over again, I don't want you just to work in little silos. We're much better off if the Department of Health works with the Department of Education and works with the Housing Department and looks at ways to leverage our assets together, to lift whole communities together, to look at initiatives that we can push forward. Probably the biggest compliment given to this president was by Bob Gates, the former Secretary of Defense, who the president asked to stay on for a couple of years as he became elected. And Bob Gates, another Kansas boy, was willing to do that.
And a Republican. Yeah, there's other Republicans in the cabinet as well. Pardon my interruption.
That's true. Well, no, he just gave the president a terrific compliment. He said he's been part of six different administrations, Republicans and Democrats. He had never seen a cabinet that was more collegial, more competent, and more together as a team, and said, Mr. President, this is all about you. You chose this. You lead this group. This is a remarkable way to operate a cabinet, and he'd seen a lot. So that was very meaningful to me to have that kind of perspective.
Does this president solicit a lot of feedback and advice from his cabinet, or is he more directing people in how to go?
No, I think he's very open to discussions and ideas, and he was certainly, as we were negotiating and debating the Affordable Care Act, this was a very hands-on effort where he was at the table, sleeves rolled up, talking about various kinds of policy choices, talking about ways to interact with the legislature. He's done that around economic policy. He certainly does that routinely around international policy. And he wants the experts there with him at the table to advise him and inform him at every step along the way.
That's marvelous. Former governor of Kansas, currently the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Secretary Kathleen Sebelius. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Sure. Thanks for visiting with me.
Thank you, Secretary Sebelius.
Bye-bye.
It's been a pleasure meeting you. 46 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more from the DNC and your calls right after this. The Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio in every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, over 200 cable systems nationwide on the Free Speech TV Network. Welcome back to the program. And on the line with us is Liz Schuler, the Secretary and Treasurer of the AFL-CIO, AFLCIO.org. Of course, the website. Liz, welcome to the program.
Welcome. Or thank you for having me on the program.
Yeah.
Welcome to the DNC.
Yeah, thank you very much. Or I should say welcome back, actually. Liz, I'm curious what your take is on the Republican war on organized labor and the Democratic efforts to fight back and push back.
A frustrating exercise. And it's great to be here in Charlotte, where we are actually embraced. People are talking about jobs, the middle class, and really about what working families' concerns are. And so it's been refreshing. And I can't tell you, how we've struggled to really get an audience and get people to listen on the other side of the aisle to what working families are going through.
Yeah. Republicans have been opposed to unions since the whole idea of unionization, with the exception of Abraham Lincoln. I mean, he was the first president who used the word strike and the first president to actually stop a police action that would break a strike. He was also the only Republican, I think, in all of history to have taken that position, because within 20 years, the Republican Party had been captured by the railroad barons and they were back to, endorsing breaking strikes and busting up unions. What's the AFL-CIO doing to move forward right now, the union movement in the United States, given all of... I mean, the union busting movement is literally a $2 billion a year industry. How do you take that on?
Yeah, the union busting movement is actually alive and well. But we're actually doing all kinds of new and innovative things in terms of helping workers organize organically. And we've seen it in places like New York and in California, where independent contractors are not covered by labor law and are working with the union movement to come together with a collective voice. And that's been really energizing and invigorating because, as you know, labor law in this country is truly broken, and it takes an act of heroism, really, to form a union in your workplace.
Yeah, it really does. Ronald Reagan was the first president in the history of the United States to put a Secretary of Labor into office who was actively hostile to labor. The Secretary of Labor's job had always been to defend the interests of labor. That was the job of the Labor Department. And Reagan flipped that upside down and established a precedent that was followed by both George Bushes after him. So we've had, 8, 16, 20 years altogether, I guess, over the last 30 of
union busting anti-labor people as secretaries of labor and, you know, drilling holes in labor laws and things like that.
I can't hear him.
Can you hear me?
We're having some
Problems here, Liz. You can hear me now? Yes, no, maybe?
He's too loud. He's drowned out.
I'm being drowned out. Okay. Liz, just curious, your thoughts on anything you want to riff on here. Can you hear me on that?
I can't hear him.
No?
I can hear
him. Okay. Liz Schuler, I'm sorry. We're having some technical problems here. We're gonna pull a plug on that and let Liz go. It can be kind of difficult to be in front of a TV camera and not have people be able to hear what you're saying, all that sort of thing. But check out the website AFL-CIO.org. Liz Schuler, the Secretary Treasurer of the AFL-CIO, and a really genuinely great person. And of course, the AFL-CIO standing there. William F. Buckley characterized conservatives as the people who stand athwart the arc of history with their hand out shouting no. The AFL-CIO is the organization that has been standing for generations, standing across the arc of history, saying, come, let's work together, let's build a middle class. I was riffing earlier about how there has never been a country in the history of the world. Look it up. You know, I defy anybody please, if you can challenge me on this, go for it. But to the best of my knowledge, there has never been a country in the history of the world that had a middle class that didn't have that middle class except by virtue of government intervention in the marketplace. And one of the major government interventions in the marketplace that has allowed countries to create middle classes is government defending the rights of labor, of organized labor. In Germany, for example, which has one of the strongest middle classes in the world, which was largely unaffected by the global recession. Why? Because the government worked with the unions. And in fact, in any country, in any company in Germany that has over 1,000 employees, half of their board of directors has to be made up of members of the union that is represented in that company, representatives of organized labor from that company. This is how the Germans have done it. And you know, I mean, of course, it was Harry Truman's suggestion to them back when they were putting their constitution back together in 50, whenever it was. But nonetheless, it has worked for them. You know, that and a national health care system, and you've got a pretty solid middle class. You've got a good social safety net. The Germans don't fall into poverty the way Americans do. And they look at us and they think, you know, what is wrong with you people? You guys are crazy. I mean, what political party would want to destroy organized labor, would want to say working people shouldn't have democracy in a workplace? That's what a union is. A union is democracy in the workplace. Unions are democratic institutions. Their members, their management, their people who represent everybody, they're elected. Unions hold elections. In fact, even the existence of a union in the workplace comes about by virtue of an election. They are democratic institutions within little kingdoms, workplaces. You know, the way that Mitt Romney ran businesses, he was the king. He went into that company and said, okay, you guys, Bain Capital recently, you know, came into this company. We had a worker from the company on our show last week and said, build a platform, build a stage. Why? Well, just do it. They built the stage. What happens? The guys from Bain Capital come in, stand on the stage, assemble a couple hundred workers and say, y'all are going to have to train your Chinese replacement workers.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And going off on that long rant in the end of the last segment about how unions are democracies in the workplace. They exist by virtue of a majority vote of workers even saying, yes, we want a union. Unions themselves are democracies. Their leadership is elected by their members. Their decisions are made by their members in democratic processes and all that sort of thing. Liz Schuler is back with us, the Secretary Treasurer of the AFL-CIO, AFL-CIO.org. Do we hear each other now, Liz?
Hi, Tom.
Hi, it's working.
Yes.
It's magic. It's magic.
Technology, we love it.
Indeed. So, I think that what we were talking about at that time was the state of labor. I'm curious your thoughts on the Romney-Ryan view of organized labor.
Well, we couldn't have two more stark views of these candidates and their positions on working families, and particularly unions. And we've seen what the Republicans did last week in Florida and the agenda they outlined, and I saw a lot of union bashing. And this week, it's been a shot in the arm to see the conversation shift to the needs of the middle class and working families, and what do we need to do to rebuild this country?
Yeah. I mean, I regularly defy Republicans, libertarians, right-wingers of all varieties to show me any country in the history of the world that had a strong middle class that didn't get there by virtue of organized labor and government stepping in and saying we're going to defend the rights of organized labor.
Absolutely.
I just don't think that there's one that exists. And in fact, most European countries, you're looking at unionization rates of 70 to 90%. In Germany, the federal government requires any company with over 1,000 employees to have half their board of directors made up of members of organized labor from that company.
It's a very different world.
it is a different world. And what it does is it creates a stable, solid, secure, strong middle class. How is it that people in America don't get it? How have we gone from understanding in the 1930s, you know, when the Great Flint sit-down strike was happening and things like that, understanding in the late 1900s and through the early 1910s, 20s, 30s, the importance of organized labor, the critical nature of organized labor, to being able to listen to this Republican rhetoric and so many people swallowing this stuff? Is it because we don't have child labor in this country anymore? Is it because we don't have literally police shooting at people as they try to organize themselves? I mean, we had a pretty rough history back there in the first part of the 20th century.
No, you're absolutely right, and you outlined it beautifully. And if you look at the last 30 years and the decline in the middle class, and you overlay that downward trend with the trend line for unions and their decline, they literally mirror each other. So
yes.
As the middle class has shrunk, the union density has gone down, and the two are very much related.
And meanwhile, the top 1% goes up because they take what's left over.
Absolutely. So your question was right on point. Why is that? Why is it that people in this country don't see the connection? And that's really our job. As the union movement has shrunk, I think the relationship people have to unions has become more distant. There isn't, you know, the direct relationship that people had a father or cousin or an aunt in a union, and everybody knew the value of coming together collectively and improving your working conditions. And so that's our charge. Our charge is now to work with the community and actually show people that whether you're in a union or not, coming together collectively for a strong voice, that's how you better your lot.
Right.
And so we have a job ahead of us, and that's what we're doing.
Well, and I know the AFL-CIO even has a separate program for Americans who are not union members who would like to participate. Tell us about that.
It's called Working America, and it is the ability for people who are frustrated with the way things are going in this economy and feel that they don't have a voice and that they're kind of on their own, to come together in a community of like-minded people along with the labor movement get the message out there to these politicians, especially, that working family issues can't be ignored. And I think there's power in that. We have almost 3 million members in Working America that, again, share the same concerns and priorities, and we're mobilizing, and this is going to be what's going to help us win this election.
Right. Now, one of the reasons why Republicans have historically been hostile to unions is that unions have been a source of money and shoe leather for the Democratic Party. I don't know where to go with that other than to point it out and ask, you know, shouldn't this tell Americans something that, you know, organized labor is with the Democrats and vice versa and the Republicans are opposed to them? I mean, isn't there an obvious message just out of that fact?
There is an innate connection in that we look at the issues, and you know, where the candidates stand on health care and retirement security and fair pay and women's rights, and all of these issues are important to all working Americans. Mm-hmm. And so regardless of party, we look at the issues, and it just so happens that Democrats care about and have the same values as the union movement and working Americans. So I think it's very obvious. There is no, as I said, clearer a picture than what we've been seeing this week as opposed to last week in the difference in agendas. And who's fighting for the middle class and who's fighting for the 1%? It's very stark.
Yeah, Romney Ryan, we are the rich guys. It is really quite extraordinary. The largest unionized employer in the United States, is non-unionized. That's Walmart. The second largest employer in the United States is unionized. It's the U.S. Postal Service. And 5 years ago or so, the Republicans put a poison pill into legislation about the post office, requiring them to start funding the health benefits of their retirees 75 years from now. And because the Postal Service was doing so well, they were so profitable, they were actually talking about taking 70% of their fleet and converting them to solar-powered vehicles and, you know, electric vehicles and things. And the Republicans were like, we can't have this. We've got to destroy. Now I realize that this, I don't think these are AFL-CIO workers. I'm pretty sure they're AFSCME workers, aren't they?
Postal workers?
The postal workers, yeah. What union is that?
APWU, letter carriers, rural letter carriers. There's a number of postal unions that actually work very cooperatively. And have been part of the solution, frankly, in finding ways to make the business of our postal service run more efficiently.
Right.
So they've been a real asset.
Well, and I'm curious, what's the AFL-CIO doing? This is the largest unionized employer in the country. Are you participating in the fight to help protect the post office?
Yes, absolutely. And there's legislation that's been proposed, you're probably familiar with, that's been introduced in several Congresses to actually release the Postal Service from that benefit, the obligation to keep that benefit in an overfunded situation. Their fund is overly funded. We don't have many pension plans that are in a situation like that.
Yeah.
Retirement security. It's about doing it smartly. And the union movement, again, wants to be part of the solution and really, keep retirement security for all Americans.
Yeah, absolutely. And well said. What can Americans do who are watching this program or listening to this program right now to help advance the cause of the middle class, which in a very large way is the cause of organized labor? What can, in the minute we have left here, Liz Shuler, the Secretary Treasurer of the AFL-CIO, what can Americans do? What should people do?
Well, first of all, I think being educated on the issues, as we've talked about, and I'm sure your listeners know, the hot button issues that the Obama administration's been talking about all week. Educate yourself on the issues so that you're enabled to talk about the differences between these candidates with your friends, family, and community, and then really getting out to vote. And that's where working families can really show their muscle, because, as you know, the money that's flowing into this campaign season, it has been insane due to Citizens United.
Yeah.
And so really, how do we counterbalance that, right? It's with people power and boots on the ground.
There you go. Liz Shuler, Secretary Treasurer of the AFL-CIO, AFL-CIO.org. Thank you, Liz.
Thank you, Tom.
You are a great spokesperson for working people in America.
As good as you.
Well, we're doing it together here, Liz.
Thanks
a lot.
Appreciate it.
16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back next, up next, Joe Madison's going to be with us, the host of the Joe Madison Show. Stick around.
Playing a long game here, and that change is hard, and change is slow, and it never happens all at once, but eventually we get there. We always do.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Yes, we always get there one way or the other. Joe Madison is on the line. The eagle has landed. He's the host of the Joe Madison Show, joemadison.com. Joe, can you hear me? No, somebody else has his attention.
Oh no, you've got my full attention.
Joe, you're here.
You have my full attention. I'm sorry,
okay,
man. Let me apologize. I think that you know, well, you know how it is.
I know how it is.
You know, a lot of friends and people you haven't seen in years, and of course, that's what can you do?
Yep.
You know,
yeah.
Say hello. But I'm here. You've got my full attention.
I was just saying the eagle has landed.
Yes, sir.
Joe Madison, joemadison.com. Joe, you recently had, and last night Michelle Obama just knocked it out of the park. It was one of the best speeches I've ever seen in my life, by anybody, just period. You spent some time with Michelle Obama. You spent time with her husband, Barack Obama, as well. But you interviewed her recently. I'm curious, you know, what your thoughts are on that, you know, what came out of that interview and what your thoughts are on Michelle Obama.
Well, we had what I guess turned out to be an exclusive interview the day before, we were able to air it. And I asked her a very simple question. You know, 4 years ago, you had to introduce yourself and your husband and family to a nation that really didn't know you other than through campaigning. How is it going to be different this time? And, you know, she said, look, I'm going to talk about the human side of being president of the United States. I'm going to talk about how I felt when I first met him, how I fell in love with him, how he's the same man I fell in love with. And then she also spent a great deal of time talking to me about how she wanted to talk about the work that she and Jill Biden, Tom, had done for the families of veterans. She pointed out that it's very difficult when families of veterans have to move from one city to another, and let's say they're professionals, like a professional nurse or a teacher, and they have to get recertified every time they move. And President Obama, because of her work with the families, was able to get laws passed or an act that allowed these individuals to cut that certification time so that when they moved from, let's say, one base to another base in another state, they could continue to occupy or continue their occupation. But I got to tell you, the difference between Ann Romney and Michelle Obama was every last one of us could relate. I related to that first date, and the kind of car that we all had. You know, I related to a family, a grandfather who, you know, gave me $50 when I went off to college, and that was, you know, a struggle for him. Mm-hmm. I related when she said, it's not how much money you make, it's how much difference you make in people's lives.
Right.
That's what I related to, because that's what, and I could hear my grandmother as she was talking. I had flashbacks of my grandmother telling me, Joe, there's always going to be poor people. There's always going to be people who have less than you. There's always going to be people who have more than you, but always treat everybody the same. Mm-hmm. That's what I heard yesterday.
Yeah, that's a noble message, and she's an extraordinary messenger. I'm curious, a little off topic, but I'm curious, Alan West was just appointed as head of the one of three heads of the Black Leadership Council for the Republican Party.
Well, that means what? He's head of what? Three people? I mean, of all the people that you would put head of anything in the Republican Party. Look, this man wasn't even allowed to sit in the front row at the Republican National Convention. They put all their crazies in the back. And they did. And, you know, because they had the moderates on stage. You know, they didn't have any of their extremists out front.
You know, you're right.
Now, you know that, and people ought to understand the optics of that. Yeah. Alan West didn't have a speaking role. You didn't have that many African-Americans. He's got to be one of the most outspoken African-Americans. He didn't have a speaking role. You got Herman Cain. He didn't have a speaking role. So what? You've dug to the, you know, you remember when we were young, you remember the cheap wine they used to sell in the liquor store?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, the
Thunderbird
Boone's Farm and all that.
Boone's Farm.
That came from the bottom of the barrel.
Yeah.
And that's exactly, as far as I'm concerned, what they've done with appointing Alan West. They've dug to the bottom of the barrel. You know, let me tell you something. I'm so angry with some of these guys. We've got a guy here who's on one of our channels here on Sirius XM. And yesterday, after the speech, he actually told his audience, the only criticism he came up with at the end of the speech was that Democrats don't know how to clean up after themselves. Look, they left all the litter and signs down. And do you know that he said, he told his audience, I'm going to go down there and help clean up the litter. And did it.
That's strange.
I mean, how weird is that? I mean, here we are talking about, I just heard you talking about health care, public policy issues. We're talking about deficit spending. And all he could come up with from yesterday's speeches, and by the way, he's a veteran, and all he could come up with yesterday was, well, the Democrats littered the Time Warner cable arena, as if the Republicans picked up their signs in Tampa.
Right, yeah. It's remarkable. Joe Madison, The Joe Madison Show on Sirius XM. JoeMadison.com is the website. Joe, it's always an honor and a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much.
My best to you and your family.
Thank you. And the same to you and yours. Joe, thank you very much. We'll be back 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
28 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back with more from the DNC and my thoughts and your calls after this. No, that is not Clint Eastwood's music. It's actually something just sounds similar to it. And this is The Good, the Bad, and the very, very preparatiously ugly, The Good. U.S. District Judge K. Michael Moore. Yesterday, Judge Moore ruled that Florida's policy of charging in-state students higher in-state tuition for college if their parents are illegal immigrants violates the Constitution. Moore argued that the policy violates the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution by forcing the students to pay nearly three times that of other Florida students with legal U.S. citizen parents. The lawsuit was initially filed by the Southern Poverty Law Center on behalf of many Florida students who were denied regular in-state tuition. If you are born in the United States, you are a U.S. citizen, and as a result, you deserve all the rights and freedoms that come with citizenship. Kudos to Judge Moore for standing up to Florida's outrageous policy and giving thousands of students greater access to an education. The bad. The state of Virginia. Thanks to an incredibly lax gun law in the state, last year Virginia issued a staggering 1,632 concealed carry permits to non-Virginia residents alone. That's right. The state allows people who don't even live in it to obtain Virginia concealed carry permits. And even more shockingly, eight states allow people with Virginia concealed carry permits to carry a gun without a permit from their home state. On top of all this, companies that offer legally mandated training for concealed carry permit holders specifically advertise Virginia classes in other states because the classes are so lax. So not only does Virginia have lax gun laws, but it's also arming non-Virginians and promoting increased gun violence across the nation. And the very, very ugly Monsanto. Monsanto, the GMO food and agribusiness giant, will soon be introducing its genetically modified foods directly at stores across the nation without labels saying that the foods are genetically modified. And if that isn't bad enough, new reports suggest that some strains of Monsanto's genetically modified corn have helped to create superworms that are resistant to pesticides. And to make matters even worse, these superworms are devouring crops in part of the already drought-devastated Midwest and are projected to spread throughout the entire Midwest. So while Monsanto continues to put genetically modified foods, which contain dangerous chemicals, on the market, they also have managed to create another nightmare for hurting farmers and agriculture in America. And that is very, very ugly.
That's very ugly.
That's incredibly ugly. I don't know how to say it beyond that. Steve in Miami, Florida. Hey, Steve, thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. What's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Yeah,
I don't think today's show would be complete without mentioning what Judge Sean Lane did yesterday in New York City in his courtroom about less than a block from the Bull in Wall Street. And he allowed American Airlines with $6 billion of cash in the bank to abrogate a contract between its pilots and the management.
Really?
A contract's been in place since 1936 and, you know, a product of 70 years of collective bargaining.
So the United or American Airlines?
American.
So the American Airlines pilots got screwed yesterday in court.
Yeah. And their pensions were terminated, health care, sick leave.
Amazing.
Work rules.
Yeah.
The ability of the company to outsource jobs, all basically now under the purview of the company can do whatever they please to do.
That is so sad.
The company did that with $6 billion of cash.
Yeah.
The pension fund was underfunded by $92 million. The CEO of American Airlines is said to be walking away with 1% of the value of the company emerging from bankruptcy, which is $60 million.
Wow.
So, there should be some good investigative journalism on this. Everybody's involved in this from the Bain Capital Group is getting paid thousands of dollars a day to help American Airlines in this move. And the attorney, Harvey Miller, who was Lorenzo's bankruptcy and helped to tear apart Eastern Airlines back in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
So, man, I tell you, I'd love to see some follow-up, reporting on this because, the pilots union is going to need all the help they can get. There's no one, and it goes right from Obama, President Obama, what he can do for labor to the Railway Labor Act or National Mediation Board.
Yeah.
The way that things are now, they're totally stacked against the union.
Yeah.
Bankruptcy court. It's set up basically to draw
to
down
bust
the
unions. Yeah. No, I'm with you.
Yeah.
And this, again, we can thank Ronald Reagan for starting all this stuff. Amazing.
Yep.
Steve, thank you very much for calling.
I appreciate this. This happened yesterday. It's a brand new story. I hope someone pays a little attention.
Yeah.
Appreciate your time.
Thanks for the ringing the bell on it. I appreciate your call very much. Mike in Memphis, Tennessee. Hey, Mike. Thanks for...
How you doing, Tom?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Hey, in reply to the Republicans talking about no mention of God in the Democratic convention, what I'd say if I was a Democrat is there's no mention of God in the Constitution. They always talk about the Constitution, not one word about God.
Yeah.
And also, Tom, let me give you these little factoids. Reagan, godfather of neoconservatives, increased the federal workforce more than any president since LBJ. Clinton, the hero of Democrats, cut funding to the NEA by a large percentage than any other president. But Nixon and Ford outperformed all administrations on Democratic issues like federal spending on social programs. And no president created more jobs than Jimmy Carter in each year in office.
Really?
Did you know that? Yeah, and you can look this up under the book, Presometrics. Now, I didn't write the book. I have nothing to do. I just read it.
Right.
But it's a good book. It compares all presidents all the way back to, I think, to Eisenhower.
Remarkable.
And here's another little factoid. In 23 years since Democrats occupied the White House, there were 42 million jobs created. In 28 years, 5 years more under Republicans, 24 million jobs created.
Yeah. Yeah, Democrats have always been better at job creation than Republicans. That's interesting. I didn't know that about the Carter administration. That's fascinating. Mike, thanks for calling and sharing the stats with us. Jason in Washington, D.C. Hey, Jason, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good.
Hey, I just thought it was funny you bringing up the stuff about countries spending themselves or cutting back in history. The thing I want to point out to you is essentially once a country spends more than 80% or debt to GDP, it's almost impossible for them to get back to any sort of normalization process. So the idea of
how did we do that after World War II then? We were at 127% of the GDP.
Let me explain it to you, Tom. The United States was left after World War II with the rest of the world where it had to purchase all of its major manufacturing goods from the United States.
Not true.
We were in a position.
Not true. Go back and look at our trade. Go back and look at our trade numbers. At the last year of World War II, our international trade was less than 1% of GDP, and by 1950 it was about 3% of GDP. It never went over 4% of GDP. The United States did not rebuild itself by selling its things to Germany and to France and Japan and all those other countries. In fact, under the Marshall Act, what we did is we loaned them money. We didn't sell them goods. We loaned them money so that they could rebuild their own machine tools, their own factories, their own concrete plants, their own whatever it may be. Just go back and look at the trade numbers in the United States. We did not build this country based on exports after World War II. We built this country based on Eisenhower investing in the United States.
The inflation rate in 1946 was 18.41%. What we're doing right now is we're robbing all of the people that are savers to reward all the people so that they can go further into
hospital. Our inflation rate right now is under 3%. What are you talking about?
You have $1 million in the bank, Tom. Can you live off of $1 million off the interest alone?
I don't, and I couldn't.
No, you can't. And what's going to happen, Tom, is in the next 6 years, we're going to have a lot of the pensions in the country all start to fail because they're not earning enough money as a return on their money to support what they're doing.
Right. So we have to have a certain amount of inflation.
It's going to be the exact same problem because they're rolling their treasuries. So they're going to roll from the fives and the fours into the one and a halves. And the payments and the obligations they have aren't going to be there.
So what you're predicting is inflation. And yeah, I don't totally disagree that at some point we're going to have that. But, you know, what we've been doing is, we've been keeping it low so that we can get, so that our borrowing costs are low. And the argument that Paul Krugman makes and that I think is a really smart argument is that right now while borrowing costs are low is the best time to invest money in things that you know are going to produce an actual return on investment and over the short term. For example, as Eisenhower demonstrated, when you put $1 trillion into infrastructure, you will make back $2, 3, 4, 5 trillion in tax revenue over the next decade. And
not
so
if the
it's
bridge
a
goes to nowhere.
Very, very wide. I'm not suggesting a bridge,
to, nowhere.
Bridge to nowhere. There are huge chunks of this country that need infrastructure in order to be able to rebuild, for example, manufacturing. Look at up and down the Northeast Corridor. You know, if we were simply to start enforcing the Buy America Act, which is part of federal law, just for federal contracts, or start changing our trade policies and rebuild our infrastructure the way that the Chinese did so that they could have factories. I mean, I was in Shenzhen back in the early 1980s. It must have been 82, 83. Louise and I were in Shenzhen, China, when it was considered the Northwest Territory or something like that of Hong Kong. It was this remote territory. It was this little town. It had maybe 6,000 people. You had a bunch of the middle of the dirt road that ran through the middle of town was filled with people selling chickens and dogs and snakes to eat. We went to the fanciest restaurant in town, and the bathroom was an open-air stall with a hole in the floor. And in fact, Louise had to help this elderly woman in there, you know, kind of squat over it. And I mean that China said, okay, we're going to take that northwestern territory, that little town of Shenzhen, and we're going to turn it into an experiment because it was a reasonable short drive from Hong Kong. So they built high-speed rail from there to Hong Kong, and then they started building out the highway infrastructure, highways, factories, and that was the starting point, and that was the explosion of China. We could be doing the same thing right here, right now.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
46 minutes past the hour. Back with more. My thoughts, your calls, and perhaps a guest from the DNC. We'll see how it goes.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy.
Well, if the Democratic Party has anything to say about it, we will see some good, positive, incremental changes. David Bender on the line with us, progressive strategist and broadcaster with ProgressiveVoices.com, the website. David, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Tom. It's good to be back. This is my 12th one of these.
Really?
Started with Grover Cleveland. And,
I guess.
No, seriously, this is my 12th in a row going back to Chicago in 1968.
Wow.
It's very bizarre. It's like living in summer camp and Groundhog's Day at the same time.
Yeah.
But it is there is, in fact, a real energy here. Now, one shouldn't get confused by that. There was incredible enthusiasm in 1972 for George McGovern, mm-hmm. and we know how that turned out.
Yeah.
Incredible enthusiasm for Walter Mondale in 1984, and we know how that turned out. Each of them took one state.
Yeah.
But this feels different. so far. And it's not just last night, the incredible speeches, but there is a sense of real possibility and sense that the president is starting to find his mojo. We will find that out shortly from Bill Clinton.
Yeah. Yeah, and your thoughts on the enthusiasm gap. There was an interesting op-ed today over at Common Dreams by a woman who had been canvassing for Obama door-to-door in Madison, and she finally gave up. She was in progressive neighborhoods, and people were openly hostile, whereas 4 years ago they were you know, they all had Obama signs out in their front yard, but they were like, you know, he hasn't done enough. And, let me let you respond to that.
Well, Tim Kaine was saying the same thing about Virginia. There were signs all over rural and suburban Virginia 4 years ago. Those signs aren't there. It's not the same kind of visible enthusiasm. This is going to come down to something very simple. This will either be a referendum on Barack Obama, and as you've pointed out rightly, there will be, because of Citizens United, so much money spent on the other side trying to make it about Barack Obama. Whether factually or not is not important. It will be done in a finite period of time, 60 days in 8 or 9 states with $1 billion spent.
Right.
If it is a referendum on the fictional, the imaginary President Obama that Clint Eastwood was channeling, then it's a problem. If it is, however, a choice between Barack Obama and his record that he is running on, and he's proud of, and I think we've heard a lot about, we're going to hear a lot more about the actual record, not the mythical record, and Mitt Romney. And this is where, Tom, I think it's going to be very interesting. You talked about the debates with a caller a minute ago. Barack Obama is running on his record. We've started to hear that very clearly tonight. We're going to hear it from Bill Clinton and hear it from the president himself tomorrow. Mitt Romney is running away from his record. And that's what we're, if that contrast happens, if we get these two chief executives, each have held 4 years of running an entity, and Mitt Romney cannot point to anything. He left office at 63% disapproval. He could not run for re-election in Massachusetts. And that, I think, is significant. And that, if that's the contrast, then we win.
Yeah. And what do you think is the billionaire factor going to be? I mean, we've seen, on the one hand, we've seen elections where, you know, they came in with a lot of money. Alan Grayson down in Florida, I think, is a good example.
Sure.
And ran, just carpet bombed the community with ads that were filled with lies.
Yep.
And people voted Alan Grayson out. On the other hand, in California, you had Carly Fiorina and Meg Whitman, who were both multimillionaires.
Self-financed, interestingly.
Self-financing their campaigns, as Mitt Romney did 4 years ago with $40 million of his own money.
Right.
But people looked at all that money that was being spent and just figured these ads are representative of those millions and millions of dollars, and therefore they're less meaningful. And Jerry Brown, you know, won the governorship spending, you know, I mean, you
a
live
fraction.
In California, you probably
yeah.
know it had to be a 50th
much, yes,
of
much
what Meg
less,
Whitman was paying.
But it tended to work in those cases with Fiorina and Meg Whitman. It worked against them because people felt like they personally were trying to buy their own election.
Right.
It works differently, and it should be even worse, but the Koch brothers masked through these independent groups with sort of fuzzy, warm-sounding names.
Americans for Bunnies in the Fields.
Americans
yes.
for Bunnies and people who love moms
yeah.
Spend $1 billion. It feels differently. Now, here's what is interesting. We did see the canary in the coal mine for this with the Scott Walker recall.
Yeah.
That's where I think it wound up being 8-1 that Scott Walker outspent Tom Barrett. And if you looked at the polls, Tom Barrett should have won. He
yeah.
really should have. Scott Walker was deeply unpopular. But they lied about him, and they did it by a factor of 8-1.
Well, they also changed the topic. They changed the topic from should Scott Walker be recalled to should there be a recall
exactly.
election.
Exactly.
And so
exactly.
a lot of people who actually thought Walker should be recalled didn't vote to recall him, because they had spent those millions and millions of dollars in Wisconsin and changed the subject.
Exactly. And it was effective, and it was smart. I wonder what would have happened if Gray Davis had figured it out with Arnold Schwarzenegger. But
yeah.
all of that said, we have seen what can happen when that amount of money is dumped in. And remember, we are talking, and I got to tell you, I'm sitting in a state, and I wondered how it would play out. North Carolina started airing Gary Bauer's anti-gay marriage ads last night. For the first time, they just went up. And a couple reading a newspaper say, oh, my, President Obama, actually they say Obama, is forcing gay marriage on us. That's not the change we voted for. Now, those ads are going to be running for every day, every minute. We're on MSNBC here in North Carolina.
Does that husband go running out screaming, heading for a gay bar?
He runs out screaming for Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan, who look like a gay couple.
Yeah, really, they do, actually. it's quite remarkable. David Bender, always wonderful talking with
always
you.
Always a pleasure, Tom. All the best to you and Louise.
Thank you, David, and to you and everyone in your family and realm. ProgressiveVoices.com, by the way, the website where you can find more about David. Tomorrow is the final day of the Democratic National Convention. We'll have all the news from the convention floor, plus Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Jared Brown, many more guests. Best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there and get active. Occupy something. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.